History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold, as long as you and I are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then invest enough time to patiently listen as long-buried memories come to life again. Our goal is, first and foremost, to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really are inspired by these men and women who have put their lives on the line for the rest of us. I know we checked all of those boxes last time with John D. Hosey of Woodinville, Washington, a decorated veteran of both the Korean War and the Vietnam War, but there was so much of his unique story left to tell that we made an exception to the rule and decided to carry his story over to another episode. So that is what we have in store for this hour today. And if you missed the first part of his story, how he lied about his age and enlisted in the Army at 16, becoming a paratrooper in the Korean War, where he received the first of three Purple Hearts, also how he met his wife of 66 years, Sandy, you can access all of that in the podcast version of that episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Today, we're going to get to hear about the mission that earned him the Silver Star and left him with his second Purple Heart. And of course, we're going to hear about the third as well. When we left off last time, he was explaining how one of the celebrities he transported as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam was the actress and entertainer Martha Ray, quite well known for her support of the troops during that era.
When she came home, she called Sandy, invited Sandy up to her home and everything. Well, the funny part was when she called and got Sandy on the phone, she says, "This is Maggie." Sandy says, "Maggie, I don't know any Maggie." She says, "Martha Ray, the big mouth." And she said, oh my. And Sandy was pregnant with our last daughter at the time. She says, "Now don't drop the bread out of the wagon or out of the basket." And so they talked for a while, and then she told Sandy that she had just left me. I was flying with a pretty level head and everything, and that she was almost positive that she would see me again. And she says, "And when he gets back, I want you to come up to Hollywood here to see us." So Sandy wrote me and told me about Martha Ray calling her and everything, and it made my day when they did that.
It sure seems. As I hear you talk about Martha Ray, and maybe it's because right behind you there's a medal on the wall that's got her face on it, and that was presented to you. But I hear a lot of respect in your voice as you talk about her and her commitment to you guys, the troops.
Oh, yes. I would give her an A+ as far as her respect for the troops and for her commitment to the troops. I flew her into Special Forces camps where other entertainers wouldn't even dare go. I know that Bob Hope, he was over there a lot, always in a secure area. He came to Da Nang, but he was in a very secure area at Da Nang. So he was really in no harm, in my opinion, anytime he came over there. But every time Martha Ray came over, she was in nothing but harm's way. And that medal and all that you see there on the wall, she told her husband she wanted me to have that. The one there on the right is a ring, an airborne ring, and there's only two of those. One of them she gave to John McCain, and he put it in a museum in Arizona. That one she gave to me, and you can see where it's at. The other one is her airborne pin, and she gave that to me. This other one is a Patrick Henry medal that she was given, and it was presented to me. She's got a plaque up there that says, "To Lieutenant Colonel Hosey from Martha Ray." I put it in that shadow box because I thought an awful lot of her. I was at her home, I think, three times. When she died, I was invited to come down and speak at her wake. And I met a whole lot of movie stars. One of my favorite was Gene Barry. I met him, but I flew Tallman, the attorney against Ironside, Robert Stack, and also Wendell Corey. I had the honor of flying June Playmate of 65. She was quite cute.
Did she call Sandy when she came back too?
No. She didn't. But I also enjoyed flying the cheerleaders. I flew them two flights into places for them to do what we called handshaking tours, you know. But the biggest thing was, and I'll talk more on it later if you want me to, but I was supposed to go and pick up Robert Mitchum, one of my favorite movie stars. And that's the time that I volunteered to go in and pick up some wounded and get them out of a hot zone, and I got all shot up.
Well, and I'm thinking about what you described as that conversation between Martha Ray and your pregnant wife at home when she tells her, Maggie tells her, I'm pretty sure he's going to be back home safe. Boy, when we hear the story of this mission and what you did and the decorations you received for it and the state your aircraft was in when you got back, I think that's going to raise our eyebrows a little bit. So you were supposed to go pick up Mitchum and you passed on that to volunteer to rescue some wounded. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. I heard over the radio that this outfit was in trouble. It was what we call a MACV unit. They were in trouble and being shot up pretty bad and needed some evac real fast. One evac had gone in and got shot up, and one observer aircraft had gone in, and he had taken fire. So I called my six, and I said, I would like to fly over, take a look, see what's going on, and let you know if I want to take an attempt of going in. And he said, okay, you've been in country long enough and you know what you're doing. He says, use your own judgment. Well, in a way, that gave me an open field. So I listened to everything that was going on the radio. And whenever I got to the hot zone, I saw what was going on. They were surrounded and they had about, maybe 100-yard field of fire for them. And the enemy was pretty close all around them. And found out it was not only the North Vietnamese, but Chinese regulars also. That was firing on them. Most of the firing that I was concerned with was coming from what I called the 2 o'clock position once I hit the ground. Well, I listened to what was going on. I contacted the ground people and I said, how many wounded you got? And the captain that was in charge says, almost everybody but me. And I said, okay, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to act like I'm leaving, but when I get overhead, I'm going to chop the power, make one circle, and that one circle, I'm going to be on the ground. So you be ready to put your wounded in and get them in as fast as you can, because my door gunner is going to be protecting everything while we're on the ground. Well, I contacted the Air Force that was giving close air support for them, and I told them what I was going to do. And I said, if you'll keep most of your fire off to the southeast of us right there, into the tea trees, if you'll keep most of your firing in to that area, I'll land to the east and I'll take off to the east. And I got a roger on that. So I told my crew, I said, watch for fire. Any place you see fire coming at us, you fire back. I said, once you start taking fire, don't stop. I made my circle and started to the ground, and all firing stopped. I thought, but I hit the ground. I was on the ground about 5 seconds, and all hell broke loose. We started taking fire, and I know you, like me, you've never been inside of a popcorn machine, but that's what it sounded like. As the bullets came in and out through the chopper, it sounded like I was in a popcorn machine. Pop, 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 pop. They started loading up the wounded and everything. And when they hollered, go, my co-pilot says, I'm hit. And according to what my six said, right behind him came me too. And he said, I've never heard the calmness that I heard, John, in your voice. He says, it was just me too. And he says, I thought, uh-oh, I've lost a crew. But then he said, the next thing I heard you was airborne. But in between that, I tried to pick up my chopper, and I gave it too much power, too much, I pulled too much collective in. I heard, and I looked around, and all of my instruments had been shot out. So now I'm going to fly by the seat of my pants. So what I did is I set the chopper back down. I raised it up. You've seen a chopper. The skids are curled on the front, on the end of it. Well, that's so that you can do a run and takeoff. I picked it up on those skids, and whenever I picked it up on the skids, I started down between tea trees. My gunners were both firing, and they were picking up leaves on the end of their machine gun from the trees. And as I got a little bit of speed, I popped the chopper up and then leveled off again and tried to start to climb. And my co-pilot, I looked over and he was bleeding, and I hollered at my crew chief to get up there and put a tourniquet around his legs. I had been hit in the right calf, and there was one bullet that my camera was hanging on the instrument panel, and that camera took a bullet that was meant for my right knee, and if it had hit that right knee, it would have shattered it. Now, whether we would have got out, maybe I could have left my foot on the pedal and we could have still got out, but I didn't have to find that out because that camera took that round. And you remember the old wind-up cameras? You know the winder is the heaviest part of the camera? That bullet hit that wind-up. And I could have killed my kid. He took it to show and tell, and somebody stole it from him. So I don't have the camera to show you.
But you have a story, and I just want to underscore the importance of that. So if that camera is not in that exact spot, if it doesn't hit right in that winder, it's not just you that might not be here. It's everybody on that helicopter.
Somewhere's around about 12 or 13 of us thereabouts would not be here. Anyway, I took us into a field hospital and landed. I had medics all around my chopper after I shut it down, and they opened my door and they said, understand you're hit too, sir. And I said, don't worry about me. Take care of the wounded in the back, because some of them were chest wounds and everything. And I was just hurting. I wasn't, and, you know, I was not hurt bad. So they pulled my pilot out, got him in, Jimmy Johnson, who lives in, he lived in Clinton, Washington here. Jimmy was really a good pilot. He was back with me in about 3 months after being shot through both legs. He went right through here, and the bullet hit the seat and was in the seat with him, and I kept the bullet. But he was back in the unit in about 3 months. I was only supposed to be off duty for a few days, but I wound up flying. And the worst part of me, when they got the bullet out of my leg, they did not really clean the wound really good. And the second night, I was asleep, and all at once, my leg burst open. My bed got messed up with pus from the wound, and I went to my doctor there. He asked me, who cleaned that wound? And I said, the field hospital. And he says, well, if they cleaned it, they should have put in a drain. In other words, they should have cleaned the wound and then put a drain in, because this drain should be pulled out about every 2 days and cut off and checked, and that would not have happened. And that was the worst pain that I had been in, including the shooting. The shooting was nothing except like a hot poker hit my leg. So he took care of that. And there was one Vietnamese general over there that anywhere he flew, he wanted me as his pilot. I don't know why, because he took a liking to me. But every time he had asked me if we could go somewheres or get somewheres, I'd read his map and see where, and I'd look at him and say, no problem, sir. And that's all he ever got out of me was, no problem, sir. So the day I was actually wounded, he wanted to go from where we were at there at the field hospital back to Pleiku. And he came up to me and he says, are you ready to go? I said, I can't fly, sir. I'm grounded. He says, what? I'm not going either then. But he says, I need to get back. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll let the other pilot fly his airplane. I'll fly the right seat with him, and we'll get you back. So I wound up flying constantly, even though I had been in the wounded state. But it's things like that. And I got that stick from him whenever I left Vietnam that's hanging on the wall back there. Uh-huh. But it was funny the way that some things work out that way.
Well, and that mission gave you your second Purple Heart out of three, if I'm reading the oak leaf clusters on your ribbon, right? Yeah. So there's another one we haven't heard about yet. But so it earned you a Purple Heart and the Silver Star.
That one got me the Silver Star. The one that got me the Distinguished Flying Cross was there was a chopper that was shot down, and I landed under fire to have the pilots checked out to see if they could be rescued or whatever. But both of them were dead. I don't know but what they didn't blow up the chopper after I gave them the report that the chopper was, you know, shot up, but the pilots were both dead in it.
But you risked your life to see if you could save theirs.
Right, and that gave me the DFC.
And I thought on one of the citations, there was an element of also redirecting aircraft fire that was going to kill some of your own troops, and you gave them a different location to hit the enemy.
That was part of the same mission. And yes, I overheard where they were going to hit, and I said, no, that's our troops in that area. Watch me, and I'll show you where to put your fire. So I low-leveled and dropped down and showed them, and then got my butt out of the way. And they went in and did some, that was all part of this same mission that I think saved a bunch of our ground troops.
Some pretty intense memories from 86-year-old John Hosey. He spent 29 years in our armed forces, and we're not done with his memories just yet. We've heard the stories behind two of his Purple Hearts, but there's one more to hear about, and if you visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos that tell even more of that story. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website? That's simple. CVTR.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.